Welcome to Acre Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host. And this episode, we chat to John Schreiber about his time flying the F-14 Tomcat. He also includes his time on the F-4 and a brilliant story about intercepting a MiG-23. So if you like what we do here, head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. You can also donate by going to aircrewinterview.tv/donate. Thank you and enjoy. I would like to thank our sponsor, Caliber Wings, who produce detailed scale die-cast models that strive to deliver a detailed experience that incorporates light weathering and colour toning that start from their Wave 3 models. This is finally bundled into a nice collector's box with dedicated illustrative box art to match. Please visit caliberwings.com. Thank you. Hugo, when did you first become interested in aviation?
Actually, it was in 1960, I believe, and I think it was on May 5th. Whenever Alan Shepard went up for the first time, I remember sitting with my dad in Richmond, Indiana, watching a scratchy black and white TV on broadcast news. I think it was Walter Cronkite. So what would that have been? CBS? Mm-hmm. Or I think CBS. And it just intrigued me what he was doing, you know, just the whole process of going into the rocket. And, well, at the time, it was actually a missile, a ballistic missile sitting on the top. And that was like, yeah, I want to do that. And he turned out to be a Navy pilot. And it was literally about that time I said, I guess I got to be a Navy pilot and go to test pilot school. And then I can do that cool thing.
Awesome. So what year did you join the U.S. Navy?
1977.
So can you talk us through some of the aircraft you started training on?
Yeah, the... very first Navy airplane that I flew in was my recruiting ride. It was a T-34 Bravo, so it was a piston, a version of the Bonanza. And the guy, I'm convinced now that I know what flying is, I'm convinced he was just trying to make me sick, because we went out to the operating area, and we did a squirrel cage multiple times with spins. And a squirrel cage is a loop to a half Cubanate, to a Immelmann, to a split S. And then he did through some spins in there. He let me fly some and spin the airplane. And I was just loving it. And then I went through a bunch of pre-flight stuff, you know, where they try to get rid of you with a Marine drill instructor at the Officer Candidate School. And then flew 28s out of Corpus Christi, which... when I tell people that's the very first airplane that I flew, they're like, what? How did you get to do that? And I look back on that as well. I'm like, that's a big airplane for somebody that has 0 hours of flight time. But went through that. That was about 40 hours. Then I got jets in Beeville and flew the T-2 and went to the ship for the first time. That's a roughly 100 hours, maybe a little bit less. And then went to the TA-4J, where you get your instrument certification, you do your ACM stuff, and you also go to the ship again. And then got selected to fly Phantoms out of there. Went to Miramar, and went to VF-121. And I had no idea what kind of legacy I was walking into. I wasn't a student of aviation. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the guys that I'd be flying with were aviation giants. Frank Mazzadri, you know, he did a lot of work with the Phantom and Test Pilot and Blue Angel, and just I was in a group of folks that I was amazed at who I was hanging out with.
Yeah,
you know, Duke Cunningham. All these guys, Pettigrew, Pete, just tons of really neat people. And then I did a tour, a couple of cruises with VF-154, flying Phantoms. I ended up getting 1,000 hours. My second cruise, I put together a plan several months before the cruise, to skipper in the OPSO, hey, this is how you get Hooter 1,000 hours in the Phantom. And I volunteered for every boring flight you could fly. Mm-hmm. And then when we got back from cruise, I was going to go be an instructor at VT-24 in Beeville, so I didn't transition to the F-14 with the rest of the squadron because I was ordered out. So I kind of shut down the Phantoms. In the course of shutting them down, I would go out and fly for 2 or 3 hours a day until I got my 1,000.
Why not? And,
yeah. I flew a couple solo flights to the desert to park Phantoms in the dirt, which is interesting. had a good time in the Phantoms. Then I was an instructor at VT-24 in Beeville, Texas. Then came out of there with 900 hours in the TA-4.
So, Hoota, could you tell us what it was like first landing on a carrier in the F-4 Phantom?
Yeah, that's another story. The daytime went pretty well. I think I didn't have any problems at all. Went out and got my 6 day traps in one day, off the coast of Southern California. Can't remember what ship it was on. I want to say it was the Kitty Hawk, but I'm not sure. And that was pretty much it. Once you've landed on a carrier, it doesn't really matter what airplane you're in. Mm-hmm. It's going to be about the same. And the Phantom itself is sweet on final behind the boat. I mean, I think you've interviewed a guy that has shot down a MiG that he said it's pretty rock solid behind the ship, and it is. You walk the throttles, real responsive engines, and when it lands, you know you've landed. I mean, it's a bump. Mm-hmm. So that went real well. I think I won one of my bets with my LSO, either number three wires or grade or something. I don't remember what it was, but I remember him having to give me a bottle of scotch. So that went well. My first night trap is in a Phantom. And trust me, I'm a little nervous. Sitting in the airplane behind the island in what's called the Gator Hole, where they used to park the F-8s. And there's Marines qualifying out there who are eventually going to go onto the Ranger with VF-154 or the Coral Sea. Anyway, they're going to go on some boat for some reason. And there's a full bird colonel as the LSO, basically the wing commander, I believe, or at least the squadron commander. And the first Phantom comes down the pipe. I mean, the sun, it's just gotten dark, although it's still kind of a pinky. Mm-hmm. And I see the guy coming in on final. And as soon as he calls the ball, he's a 3/4 mile, calls the ball. And it's like he shut down the engines. The airplane just started sinking.
Oh, no.
And the very first call from the LSO was wave off burner, burner, burner. And so this guy, he drops down and literally goes out of sight from me. I'm in the front seat. My backseater is watching. We got the engines turning. We're talking to each other. And the guy disappears from view and then comes up over the round down, two burner, big spikes of flame coming out of the back end of the airplane. And he wobbles up. Off he goes into the distance. And, nothing on the radio. It gets kind of quiet when the guy's out of the way. You can hear the jets on the flight deck turning. And I hear from the back seat, don't do that. So I go, yeah, fair enough. And then they taxi me out, and I get shot out right behind that guy. And off we go. And I got four night traps and did okay.
Yeah, on that note, yeah. Can you share any, you probably have many, but any memorable stories you've had on the Phantom?
The last flight in my training syllabus in VF-121 was an electronic countermeasures surface-to-ground kind of flight where we're testing the warning system, missile warning systems. We're going out flying against various radars out in the desert up by China Lake, as I recall. And the job was to react appropriately, break into the missile, get 90 degrees off, and do all these different things. So we fly up there. We tank on the way up, I think. And we make a couple runs through. One is just a test run to see, kind of get used to what you're going to see and hear. You don't really do any maneuvering. And you come back around, and you do a run just to, okay, let's see how you do your first time through, and then you come through for a full-on kind of thing. And they actually had these little fake missiles that would shoot, so you'd see smoke and look like they're tracking me, kind of thing. So I go back through there, and, you know, we're flying in combat section. We got, you know, there's two of us out there, and I'm playing like it's for real, and I broke the airplane. I broke the airplane. Over-G'd it many times. As we come out of the run, they said, okay, Phantom number two, we never could hold lock on you. So I'm like, hey, I did my job. We get back to the squadron, and it's leaking everything. We land at Miramar, you know, hydraulics are pouring out and all this other kind of stuff, and get out of the airplane, and the maintenance chief hands me a wrench and goes, fix it now. So, you know, I didn't. I'd have done more damage if I'd actually fixed it, but I bent the airplane quite a bit. And that was my last flight in the squadron. I packed up my gear and went down the runway. Or see you guys. Have a nice day.
Brilliant. So,
frequently, when you're out in my time, when you're out at sea, your missions aren't always against real bad guys. They're just kind of seeing what's going on around the ship. Well, one particular day, there's a fishing vessel nearby, 60, 100 miles away or something like that, a trawler of some sort. Well, as normal, it's a Russian ship that's spying on electronic measures, radios, and all that kind of stuff. So we fly by once, we see it, you know, yeah, sure enough, it doesn't have any fishing poles on it. Those are all antennas and radar dishes and everything else. So we have extra gas, so we go around, line up on them, coming out of the sun, and I am at the level of the steering house on that boat, maybe 40 feet above the water. And I'm at about Mach 1.2.
Blow my neck.
Yeah. And I come past those guys. I'm pretty darn close. I'm right level with the skipper of the ship, and just lay a sonic boom on them that I'm sure knocks some stuff off of shelves and pictures off of and stuff. So somewhere there's a crew of a Russian trawler telling a story of some, you know, Yankee war dog breaking their boat. So that was fun.
Okay, so we're going to have to talk about my favorite aircraft, the F-14. How did you get assigned to F-14s after F-4s?
That's a good story. I was a flight instructor in VT-24 in Beeville, Texas. That's my dog in the background. Obviously, somebody's dropping off some mail or something. Like I said, I'd blown a sinus, and I was grounded at the time. And I got a call from my detailer, and he basically said, the detailer is the guy that gives you orders where you're going next. He works in the Pentagon, and he moves people around. He's the chess he's the chess master that moves people around. So he called me up, and you know, I'd put in what we call a dream sheet, and I can't remember what I had on it, but he just asked me, he says, just tell me what coast, what airplane. So he was letting me pick whatever I wanted. And I was like, I'm actually gonna have to take a day or two to think over that. And I thought about going F-18s, but I really do like the guy in the back. I enjoy flying with somebody.
Company.
If misery likes company on occasion, yeah. I said, okay, I'm going to go with the F-14s. Might as well, instead of going to Oceania, might as well go back to Miramar. So I did. I just said F-14s, Miramar. But I also said anything but the Ranger.
Right.
So I get two of my three. I got F-14s, Miramar, Ranger. Yeah, you can't get everything.
Exactly, so, yeah. So yeah. What were your first thoughts of the mighty Tomcat?
That it was complicated. One, you couldn't taxi with the canopy open. You had to close the canopy because it set up so high it would shake and you could do some damage. I guess you could taxi, but in the Phantom, you had the two canopies and you could taxi around. It just looks cool.
It does.
14, you know, you had to lock it up, and the ECS was a lot stronger. Jesus, you know, it had a semi-glass cockpit feel to it. Mm-hmm. Not entirely glass cockpit, but semi that way. Had a better HUD and went through a whole lot of system checks that you didn't do in the Phantom. The Phantom was very basic in terms of, you know, the checks that you would do after starting. Mm-hmm. I mean, were the engines running? Yes. Do you have hydraulic power? Yes. You're good to go. You know, but this, there were so many systems on it. The fuel system wasn't as complex as the Phantom. The Phantom fuel system was insanely complex. The F-14 was fairly simple. But the radar had so many different modes on it. You had to run different tests depending on different types of weapons. So it was a lot more complex, more computer kind of thing than it was airplane kind of stuff.
Yeah. So what was the intended role of the Tomcat at this point in time?
When I got in, they were just kind of making the transition from Alpha Strike kind of stuff to fleet defense and that kind of thing. And starting to do the mixed joint operations, combined operations, stuff like that. So it was a little more complex in terms of the way you would develop a strike against a target or fleet defense and those types of things. So you do some more pretty exotic things, one of which was Chainsaw, which I'll try to summarize shortly later on. But, you know, really long stuff away from the ship, 600 miles away from the ship kind of thing. So that was different. So a lot of interdiction. We weren't doing bombcat stuff at the time. Mm-hmm. That was just happening. So we never carried bombs when I was flying the F-14. Although it had a system that was as good as the A-7 bombing system with a constant computed impact point. So you could, you know, where your Pipper was in that mode, that's where that bomb's going to hit. And the F-14 was pretty good at that, as it turns out. The addition of the Phoenix gave it a lot of reach. So it could do, you know, fleet interdiction at a great distance. So that at the time, Cold War was still going on. There were still the bears and bisons and all those other kind of big creatures that the Russians were flying and probably still flying. And it was, you know, keep the ship safe, keep the battle group safe, keep our buddies in the Persian Gulf safe and all that kind of stuff.
So could you talk us through a bit about your ground training? Was it difficult coming from the F-4 onto the F-14 that had probably more modern systems?
The radar system was a lot more difficult to understand. And the intercepts and all that kind of stuff, that geometry is all the same. So it was kind of easy for me because I'd done it in the Phantom. I wasn't just a new guy coming out of, you know, an A-7 into a fighter squadron kind of thing. And there were some guys doing those kind of transitions, or just a new guy coming out of the rag, coming out of the training command. So I had a little bit of an advantage there. There was a little bit of a F-14, F-4 mafia kind of thing. I tried not to get involved in it too much, but, you know, there was just a little bit there. As you were walking through the hallways, you weren't Hooter. You were, oh, there's one of those old F-4 guys. You know?
Yeah.
What were we, 26 years old, 28 years old, and we're old guys.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
So there was a little bit of that. But the complexity was the capability of the weapon system. Not so much the airplane. The airplane pretty much took care of you, except for the engines, and we can talk about that later.
Yes, we will. So where were you based for your training?
Miramar again, VF-124.
And could you talk us through what it was like to be based there? I mean, I'm guessing, was it famous at this point?
It wasn't Top Gun famous, because that was after... actually, I think it was. I'm sorry, it was Top Gun famous, because when I came out of Phantoms and went to Beeville to be an instructor, that's when they did Top Gun at Miramar. So when I got back, yeah, it was Top Gun famous at that time. So there was... I didn't really notice anything, but I presume there was more press about Miramar, and maybe it was more impressive to folks in the area. I run into a lot of people that say the F-14 is their favorite airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And we end up talking about it. It was Top Gun famous when I got back, and I didn't really notice it that much because it just, when you're in the middle of it, it's, you know, a lot of my friends flew in the Top Gun movie, you know, Bio.
And Bio, he,
yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about your first trip in the F-14. How did you feel about it?
Not as exciting as my first flight in the F-4 because that's my first flight in a Warbird. I'm flying an F-14. And, you know, we go through manual sweep and all that other kind of stuff. And, you know, obviously the turn is a lot better. The speeds are different. The F-4 turning speed is 4.25. The F-14 was about 320, 325, something right. like that. So just knowing those things, practicing those things and getting used to those different numbers was kind of what my goal was. It was good, but not great. And that goes back to the engine thing, because you were always concerned about cooking one of the TF-30s that you had on there. And that was, you spent a lot of time understanding how the engines were trying to make it a bad day for you.
Could you talk us through the cockpit layout and how it differed to the F-4? Was it better laid out?
Oh, for me, it was huge. I'm not a big guy. The F-4 was a lot harder to find stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There were bigger levers and the thing called a dog bone that was your weapon system down below the radar and your primary instruments down by your knees. But the F-14 was actually pretty well laid out. Most stuff was in front of you. You didn't have to look behind you for some stuff like you had to do in the A-4 or the F-4. Most of it was in front of you. A lot of stuff in the back seat that could be done without you doing it. You had, I wouldn't call it hand on throttle and stick only, but it was pretty close to that.
Okay.
A lot of things you could do just by the different switches that are on the stick grip and the throttles. The radar was great. I kind of liked the raw video that we had in the Phantom. We didn't have that in the F-14. But if you had an up system, it was pretty good, and you were getting locks, and you knew what was going on well before you got to the intercept. So it was real good in that way. And plus, you had the head-up display, which made it a lot easier to find airplanes because you had a little diamond that whoever you're locked on, it would go to whatever the limits were, I think 20 degrees or something of the nose, and that would help. It wasn't always perfectly centered, you know, but it was somewhere near. You know, the bogey might be right on the edge of the diamond, not just in the center of it, but somewhere near that diamond is where you'd find someone. So it was very helpful. And, you know, you could reach out and touch people a long, long way away. And, oh, by the way, it had a gun, which was really cool, which was really cool to shoot. It was a fun gun. It was right by your left side. Right, basically at your hip. So you're literally, you know, you're just pulling your gun up and made a cool sound and put out a lot of rounds and it was a lot of fun.
And just going back a bit, about the head-up display, it wasn't a traditional head-up display we would see nowadays on the F-14 air, was it? It was a projection onto the front windscreen, if that's correct.
No, it did have a combining glass.
Okay.
It did have a combining glass, as I recall. But it didn't have all of the stuff that you sometimes see if you look at the newer head-up displays that show flight path vectors and energy states and things of that nature. It had altitude, airspeed, had heading. I don't know if it had a wind dot or something like that, but it might have. And then when the radar comes on, you know, you'd get your range circles and your crosses and your bars and all that other stuff. And that's kind of pretty much what you looked at that point.
But a big feature of the Tomcat was the wing sweep. Can you talk us through how you even prepared for this coming from the F-4?
Just one more switch.
One more switch.
It did what it had to do most of the time. There were some things that you did to make sure everything was working that you'd do manually. And you would practice doing manual sweeping. You know, that was just an emergency procedure.
Mm-hmm.
But you almost never used it operationally in the manual mode. You just let it naturally program. That was good. I mean, it didn't throw additional pitch or anything into the airplane. It all kind of worked. It just all of a sudden, oh yeah, look, I'm at 68 degrees. How'd that happen?
You know, yeah.
You're going fast. That's why.
You're going fast.
And it was, there weren't any trim changes associated with it. Some great avionics guy or airframe guy figured that out. I think in this thing, the F-14 thing, I think it's a 38 knot difference in speed. I think on speed with the wings forward, gear down, flaps down, is somewhere around 150 knots. That would have been 15 units angle of attack, I think. And it's plus 38 knots from that.
Right.
So if you had the wings back and you're flying slow, you're still flying 180, 190 knots to keep it from stalling. Mm-hmm. I think the approach speed, if you had the wings back, I want to say it was like 17 knots, but you're right on the edge of stall, I believe. It's nothing I practice. I certainly didn't practice it in real life. We might have done it in the simulator. But it just, it's a delta wing airplane at that point, and so it's going to be a little bit faster.
So there's never been any instance on the carrier of a Tomcat wings back landing? I mean, that's probably unheard of.
Not that I know of. It might have been one of those things where if the wings were back, you were giving it back to King Neptune.
Yeah.
Don't recall, but I don't know of anyone having that problem.
2018, Caliber Wings have two new F-14 squadrons being released in the form of VF-143 Puking Dogs and also VF-33 Starfighters. They will both be in 1/72nd scale with a level of detail you'd experience on a high-quality plastic kit. They are now available for pre-order by visiting caliberwings.com. Thank you.
So we haven't talked about refueling yet. You obviously refueled in the F-14, but did the F-4 also have that capability?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the first time I refueled at night in the F-4 was basically, have you heard of the thing called Burning Man?
No, I haven't.
Okay, Burning Man is a big, exotic, hedonistic
ceremony. Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's out in the Blackstone Desert or whatever they call it up there in Nevada. That's where we did my night tanking over that behind an A6. And it's the surface of the moon and there is no light out there. So everywhere you look, it's just pitch black. And, but I got through that. That's just a side story. The Phantom, on my second cruise, my first cruise, my Rio was an old Vietnam guy. And what he would do is he'd say, slide back, get in position, tell me when you think you're in position, I'll kick in the circuit breaker. I'll have selected the probe coming out.
Yeah.
So I will have selected extend. He had the circuit breaker pulled, so it wouldn't extend. And I'd just get in position, and he'd kick the circuit breaker in because it was down by his foot, and he'd kick that in. And we'd see if I'd get the probe in the basket with having the probe there, just positioning it. Without. Mm-hmm. And we got pretty good at it. Second cruise, I did it myself. I would fly back with the probe in, mm-hmm. and then as I get in position, I'd take my hands off the throttle and lift the switch and put it and see if I could get it to go in. I got pretty good at that in the F-4. The F-14 is a little different. The probe doesn't go forward in the F-14. It actually comes out and goes back. So it was harder to do that, although we tried to do it because we do the same sort of thing where I'd get in position, add a little bit of power, then flip the switch and see if I could match my going forward with the airplane with the going back of the probe and drive it in. That was a little bit harder. Plus, bigger bow wave off of the F-15. It would physically move the basket out to the right. I'd say a couple of feet.
Really?
As you get in and you're slow, as you come in, if this is the basket, as you come in, it'll go like that. Well, there were times when there were certain failure modes of the basket or something on the giving airplane that would make the the hose swing around. And at certain points, you know, they're just like, no, I'm not even going to try it. There were times when you would contact the basket and push in, and the take-up reel doesn't take up, and you get the sine wave that goes up to the big airplane, and then it comes back faster because it's transferring the inertia or whatever it is. It comes back, and it will literally rip the probe off of your airplane. That's happened a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
So if you see that, if you see that you're getting a big sine wave, you know, you just throttle back and get out of the basket, you know, tighten it up and just get away from it. And it'll come off, and it'll go. You'd have no idea where it'll go. A friend of mine, flying a Phantom, he got into something like that, and the basket hit the side of his airplane and actually came through the side of the airplane. He had a whole cockpit. And his first question was, where the hell is the armor plating that's supposed to be protecting me?
Yeah, if that can go through, it's not looking good.
And a guy in the rag, we were in some competition, I forget what it was, but he was tanking off an Air Force plane. And an Air Force plane has a different type of system. They normally put the probe into the airplane. And when they're tanking Navy airplanes, they'll put a basket on the end of the probe so that you can get gas that way. So it's probe, drogue with the basket on it, and then we put a probe in it. Well, if you don't do that right, and what you're supposed to do is you contact it and make a U in it, and a little horizontal U. The hose will bend and basically flop into a U on the left or right side of the basket. And it doesn't matter which side it goes on. It just has to have a bend in it before flow will start. Well, if something happens on that, bad things can happen. And a buddy of mine in the F-14 rag actually ended up, the hose came off of the giving airplane and flopped around. Fuel went down the intake. Pieces and parts went down the intake. Blew up the engine. And the hose stayed on the probe.
Oh, no.
He's flying around, one engine with this big damn hose flopping around, beating the hell out of the side of the airplane, and he landed it safely and beat the daylights out of the airplane.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's a safe thing in the air, but it seems to be working so far. But
there's always going to be some.
There's always going to be tragedies or accidents. But Hooter, we have to talk about the F-14A's engines. What are the advantages and disadvantages in your opinion?
I actually wrote a point paper or a thesis or something like that at Naval Postgraduate School about the engine issue with the F-14s. And what it was politics and funding that resulted in the F-14 getting TF-30s versus whatever the Pratt & Whitney follow-on coming out of the F-15 re-engineering program.
Yeah.
Part of it was the Air Force backed out of that engine program, leaving the Navy to fund it all, which they couldn't do. So we ended up basically getting the same engine that the A7 had in it with an afterburner on. I'm going to say this, and I can't remember exactly if it's true, but I think it's true. I'm pretty sure it's true. Part of the NATOPS manual was explaining over about 15 pages what was going on in the engine. And I think there was a little phrase in there that said something to the effect, whether you know it or not, the engine is stalling.
Yeah.
Because at certain flight regimes, that particular engine couldn't keep up with the airflow properly. Mm-hmm. So you were getting little mini stalls in there. And if you look at most of the aircraft losses from the F-14 that were not, you know, flying into the water or something like that, but if you're in air-to-air or something like that, or if you spun the airplane, almost all of them were unrecoverable because you cooked one or both engines.
Yeah.
You know, you'd get into a deep stall with the engine, and it would basically crystallize the turbine, and those things would flake off, come out of the back end of the airplane, and now you got nothing. Mm-hmm. And you got a dog whistle at that point. So a lot of the airplanes... 20-some, I'm going to say, were sent into the dirt just because the engines quit way early in the whole process. Mm-hmm. So But as soon as they got the better engines in it, it got a lot nicer. And I've had a couple pretty good compressor stalls. I lost an engine, but that was my fault on takeoff. But you just had to be careful. You had to know that, one, it's going to take a little bit of time to spin up, and two, you never knew if you were going to cook them, if you got into high angle attack kind of thing. So that was the limitation. It kind of kept you from being as aggressive. The Phantom, you could do almost anything to. I mean, those J-79s, it didn't matter what the hell you threw at them. They would take it. They were just beefy, powerful engines. The TF-30s, not so much. Generally, they were good engine down low. And as you got higher and more angle of attack, then it was a little bit tougher. So where does dogfighting take place?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, kind of high, and there's usually a high angle of attack kind of stuff going on there.
So could you see the power difference from the F-14 to the Phantom?
The Phantoms I flew, there was a little bit of time where you would have greater than 1-to-1 thrust to weight.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, but that amount of time was very limited because you'd run out of gas real quick.
Yeah.
So you were at about 0.7, maybe a little higher in the Phantom, whereas in the F-14A, I think the thrust to weight was, I want to say 0.6, 0.62, something like that. And you could feel it, although the airplane was a lot slicker and you could still go fast and you could still do a lot of stuff. It wasn't that terribly limiting. But as soon as they got what they put in there, the F414s or something like that, the GE.
The 110s, I think, yeah.
110s, there you go.
Yeah.
You know, talking to my buddies that flew those things, they're like, man, the engine problem just went away. They were sweet motors, and they didn't have to worry about them at all.
And we're going to have to talk about DACT in the F-14. How did it fare against the types at the time?
Well, you have to remember, when you're doing air-to-air combat kind of stuff, DACT, I don't know if you've heard this before, but they referred to the F-14 as the flying tennis court.
Yeah.
Or the geographic center of any
off, yeah.
Because you're just huge. You see these guys from all over the place. But when you go sideways, you almost disappear.
Yeah.
And that was the big change between the F-4 and the F-14. The F-4, a gun's defense, was a real hard pull in to get their nose off of you some way, somehow. Maybe throw some rudder in to get out of the way. The F-14, you'd want to go sideways so that you got a smaller sideways target.
Awesome.
That was hard to train to. That was the hard thing that it took me a little bit of time to learn, that when a guy was coming in on with a gun solution, my tendency was to pull back into him and maybe throw some rudder, whereas now it was just go to the side, just as he gets there, just put it down so that you take the tennis court away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the biggest difference. Otherwise, flying the airplane was pretty much the same. Smaller circle, because the F-14 could turn tighter, mm-hmm. and had more G available. Had to be careful of the engines. If you got into a real low airspeed fight, the Phantom was pretty good. It could sustain itself in a low speed scissors, although you didn't want to be there.
No.
The F-14, if you get into low speed scissors, you'd be pretty slow, mm-hmm. especially if you're throwing flaps in there. But you had to worry about the engines. And again, that's just me because I flew F-14As.
So could you tell us about your first operational squadron after you left your training?
I went to VF2, where Bio was, the Bounty Hunters, Bullets, and a good group of guys. I mean, really, it was a fun place to be. We were in the same hangar as Top Gun. They were just on the other side of the hangar from us at the time. And while I was there, I think they actually started moving up to Fallon. I only made one cruise with them and then ended up going to Naval Postgraduate School, mm-hmm. Which flying is great. But once you get out of the military, who wants a fighter pilot? I mean, you know, if you're if you were going to turn your flight time into commercial airline stuff, so what? You flew Phantoms, you flew F-14s. Can you tow this banner, or you know, can you do this other stuff? And it just wasn't any place for it. But going to Naval Postgraduate School, getting a master's degree, that was a lot more helpful in terms of me getting follow-on work. So, pitch for education.
Yeah. So, Huda, can you talk us about talk us through your first deployment on the F-14 and what carrier you were based with?
The USS Ranger, which was a smaller deck than I wanted to be on. I came off the Coral Sea, which was even smaller than that. But the Ranger was a pretty small deck carrier. I just wanted a newer carrier just to have a little better living conditions. But, you know, you get what you get, and that's it. But Bug Roach was still with the air wing at the time. Oh, wow. So he was our air wing LSO. Great guy. I'm happy to have known him. We went over to the Persian Gulf, but not in the Persian Gulf. We were in the North Arabian Sea, Gulf of Oman, that kind of area. And we did some interesting things. We did these things called Earnest Wills, which was escorting tankers, ships, through the Strait of Hormuz, because the Iranians had done some mining, silkworms out there at, I think, Jask, Chabahar, some places like that. I actually still have a map somewhere in my G suit.
That's cool.
Stuff that has some of that stuff on it. And that was kind of interesting, but it wasn't green ink. It wasn't combat. That was fun. And there were some exciting things that happened on that. One thing is a guy named Jungle, he launches off after a target that's coming out that looks like it's a silkworm because it came out of Iran. It started high, dropped down low, and it's just under supersonic coming into the battle group. So this guy gets launched on it, and he gets clearance to do what he wants to do. And he just decided, you know what, this just doesn't seem right. And he continued the intercept to where he got a visual on it. Yeah. And it turned out it was a French F-8 because we were working with
French.
So he's screaming in, you know, just his radios weren't working, his IFF wasn't working or something. And, you know, he was within a few minutes of getting blown out of the air. And just because, you know, the backseater and the frontseater in that particular airplane thought, something just doesn't feel right. Let's go to a visual on this guy. And they ended up getting invited over to the French carrier and some of the air wing guys. And, you know, they had kind of a training session of, you know, if you're going to come back, at least follow the rules coming back. Don't just come straight in looking like a silkworm. Because roughly an F-8 is about the same radar cross-section as a silkworm, probably.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, you know, things like that happened. I myself had a clearance on an unknown contact. And again, me and my backseater just decided when it came up in the diamond, I could see a lot of lights. If it's a bad guy coming into the fleet, you're not going to see a lot of lights. So we went on in. Sure enough, it was an airliner. Glad we didn't shoot that down.
Definitely.
So things like that happen. That you know, it's just a matter of understanding what's going on and having having situational awareness of what's happening. I didn't have a lot of crashes in terms of the air wings I was with. I think on the Ranger, we lost an A6. I don't think we lost anything else. An A6 just flew into the water at night, one night. Didn't recover them. No calls from them or anything. They just went off the radar, and they just, as far as they can tell, just flew into the water for some reason.
Well, that's probably a good percentage for a cruise or on the carrier and, you know, one aircraft. So did you ever feel like you would actually be called to shoot down an actual Russian threat?
I've intercepted a lot. Flying F-4s, I was called to intercept. I think they were a couple of bisons. We were up in the North Pacific, and And we actually never saw them. We were told we were at the merge, but we were in the clouds, which made me really nervous because you're at the merge. There's airplanes nearby. I'm in the clouds.
I'm seeing it.
When am I going to see them?
Yeah.
We never even saw them. So I got to see, I got to escort a May, which is basically an Indian May, and I think maybe a Russian May, mm-hmm. which are basically P3s. They're just doing surveillance coming out. I never got to do a bear or anything like that. In the F-14, I got to do an intercept on a Flogger, a MiG-23, out of Vietnam, Cameron Bay. Me and my wingman were Alert 5. He was on Catapult 1. I think I was on Catapult 3. And we get the call, launch you Alert 5, bogey's inbound, whatever. So we take off. He takes the bogey to the north, who ends up going out and taking a look at the ParPro P3 that's flying up and down that they've been doing it for 40 years, doing radar, radio surveillance and that kind of stuff. So he went up there. My wingman went up there. He got some pretty good video and got some pictures. The one we vectored at, the south guy, was coming straight for the ship. And we ended up doing several turns with him. And it was basically a rolling scissors kind of thing. It was just a whole bunch of this. Yeah. And then he'd level out and kind of trying to drag me back inside the 12-mile limit so that, you know, there'd be some sort of violation, political thing. Well, we knew where it was. The E2 was telling us where the line was. And plus, we knew where it was on the radar and charts. And so we would turn to the south, and then he'd turn back, and we'd do that again. We did that about 3 times. And last time, I tried to join up on him, and he's doing everything he can do to keep me from joining up. You can see he's going from idle to burner. He's putting his speed brakes out and sweeping his wings, moving them back and forth, and just doing a bunch of jinking. But I know he's running low on gas. And at one point, I got kind of alongside of him, enough to see into the cockpit that, you know, it's a MiG out of Vietnam, out of Cameron Bay, and this guy is stuffed into the cockpit. He's got a leather helmet on, and he's got this great big red relief pitcher mustache, and he's, I don't know, 6'3", 230 pounds. It looks like a football player sitting in the cockpit. And we tried to get a picture, but we weren't able to. He broke into me, and I just kind of went over the top of him. Not Tom Cruise kind
not
of right
Tom
there.
Cruise style, no.
Yeah. This guy breaks in, and I just go up like that and keep an eye on him, come around. He levels out, and he goes inside the 12-mile line, and I kind of turn out at an angle just to make sure he doesn't come back out. He doesn't come back out. We land and go back and debrief it, and it was kind of cool. It's a fun story.
So why didn't he want to, you know, form it up? Like, what was his, do you think his reasons were?
Probably didn't want me to know that he's either an Australian guy flying a mercenary or that the Russians are flying out of Vietnam. Right. And I think, as it turns out, that was the intel that, because they were Flogger Ks, that was the intel that said that the Russians were flying out of Vietnam.
So what was like life like on the carrier at this point?
You know the movie Groundhog Day?
Yeah.
Pretty much that. I mean, VF2 on the Ranger was pretty nice because we had no watertight doors between our bunk rooms and our ready room. Mm-hmm. So when we go to general quarters on the ship, that's when they kind of lock everything down and make compartments where one will flood and the other ones don't. And whoever's in there, see ya. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have anything between our ready room, our bunk rooms, and I think the dirty shirt wardroom. I think we had, it was like an en suite kind of environment for us. So when we went to general quarters, it became a private country club for us, basically.
Wow.
You know, we could go get some food, although they weren't supposed to be cooking. There was usually something there, and you could go get a soda or whatever. And we could go up into the ready room, go down to our bunk rooms. It was not too bad. On the Coral Sea, my first cruise on the Coral Sea, I was in a 8-man, I think, bunk room, and a bunch of Lieutenant JGs, an ensign or two, and maybe a lieutenant. And sometimes ship's company would come in and do maintenance on the catapult track that was over our spy's head, our intel officer's head. He was the junior guy, so he got the worst bed in the literally, there was a grease cert right over his head. So, and unless the guy would come in the middle of the night and would grease that thing and try to wipe it off, but our spy would frequently wake up in the morning with grease on his face from it getting hot and melting. So that was that.
Did you do any interesting flybys of the carrier?
Oh yeah, that was kind of standard stuff. You know, every once in a while you'd get a call to fly by the carrier or another ship or something like that. So that was fairly standard. I don't think I ever did a supersonic flyby of the carrier. I did a supersonic flyby of a destroyer, and I loved it. I know everything went fine. Sometimes they don't. You know, you've probably seen the videos of, you know, the guys having to jump out of the airplane that have the engines exploded as they pulled up. F-14A.
Seeing that.
So they got out, you know. It wasn't the Dale Snodgrass kind of thing where you come by at flight deck level with, you know, full wings at you know, hey guys, how you doing? Although we did, quick story here. We had a new guy join us late in our workups, went out on the cruise with us, call sign Pager, and he was, you know, Academy grad, good kid, good stick. And I remember him asking, like, hey, when we do this alert five stuff, you know, how do you behave when you take off? You know, he just kind of wanted to get the feel because he didn't know, and we hadn't done any of it, and he was going to be one of the first guys to stand on alert five. And so we told him, well, what you do is, you know, normal case one procedures taking off of the ship is you do a clearing turn to get out from in front of the ship in case you have to go in the water. And then you go straight out and you stay at 800 feet or something like that and climb. He said, and we told him, you know, just turn immediately to the vector they give you. He took that very literally. So he launches off the Wastecat and he full 90 degree angle bank and as much G as he can put on it as he's cleaning up the airplane. And he flies right in front of the ship. I don't know that he was 100 yards in front of the ship.
Wow.
And you look into the cockpit and see these guys. I mean, it was just planned for him. And he rolls out and climbs up and heads off on the vector. And we're all like, oh, my God. He got to meet a lot of senior people when he got back.
I can imagine, yeah. In big trouble, yes.
Yeah. So it was an impressive shot, though.
I can imagine. So, Huda, how many hours did you get on F-14?
I think a little over 400 because I only did one cruise. Yeah.
Not bad.
And then I went to Naval Postgraduate School and then ended up in Korea and the wall came down and there weren't flying jobs left for guys that hadn't been on cruise for the previous 3 years. If you, as the saying goes, if you weren't haze gray and underway, you weren't getting back into a cockpit.
So I'm going to ask you a really tough question before we get onto the personal side. Which would you rather fly, the F-14 or the F-4?
Considering the F-14s I flew, I would go with the F-4.
Okay.
If I had the chance to go fly a D, I would pick that because it was awesome from everything I heard. Mm-hmm. At one point in my life, I had orders to fly F-15s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and as soon as I went to cruise, those changed, and that's why I ended up being an instructor in Beeville. But I had orders to cross-train with the Air Force, fly, go over to Luke in Phoenix. I would have loved to have flown the F-15. I think that would have been just a great airplane to fly.
I think, yeah, the F-14, F-15 debate is going to be going on forever, but did you ever get to fly up against the F-15s?
Oh, yeah.
I'm guessing that's we didn't really do well.
I flew against them in the F-4.
Right.
And the F-15 was far superior because it not only had a vertical fight that it could sustain, mm-hmm. it had a level slow speed fight that it could sustain. And the interesting thing I remember from F-15s was it generally I would get beat down in energy and the F-15 would kill me. But as you look back at an F-15, you know, as you're flying like this, they have the beacon is right on the leading edge near the engine, mm-hmm. kind of close to where the gun is. And it actually looks like he's shooting at you if you're sitting there under about 8 G's looking back at this guy. Like, yeah, he's actually shooting at me. It's an impressive sight, though. They're very good airplanes. We'd fight them out over the water every once in a while, but the advantage we had was a slightly better radar. So if we got a long setup, we could kill them at a distance, although they had a pretty good radar, too. Mm-hmm. But it was a fairly even fight if you fought a smart fight. You know, if you made a mistake or something or tried to be fancy, if you came in and you didn't have the right solution and you just blew through and went away, you could get away. But if you got slow and had to fight your way out of it, the F-15 was going to beat you. Again, that was with the old engines. Because you would either cook an engine if you really wanted to. It did what you wanted to do, but that was the problem.
So, do you have any hobbies?
Nowadays, hobbies have kind of taken the back seat to just paying bills. You know, I have my own business, so I've got a couple people doing government work, and I'm doing some work with some folks in the UK. I don't know if you know Worth Research up in Bicester. They race cars, and they're doing some work with Lockheed Martin with some unmanned systems and some other stuff as well.
Check them out.
But I got hooked up with those guys, and I'm doing some work with them. But it has nothing to do with aviation or race cars. These guys are race car guys forever. F1, IndyCar, their designs have won, I want to say, 13 of the last 15 Indy 500. So they're pretty good at what they do.
Cool.
I'm doing stuff for them that's literally cool. We're helping cold air stay in refrigerators. You'll find some of their stuff in Marks and Spencer, Waitrose.
Oh, no. Wow. We all know that over here.
Yeah. And we're getting out in the U.S. So completely out of the military kind of thing. I ran into Nick Worth at JPL, and that's how I got hooked up with him. Also doing some work for Harris Corporation and Leidos, which is a spinoff from Lockheed Martin. So that takes up a lot of my time. I still fly. Mm-hmm. I fly with the Sky Typers, which we do sky riding. It's not the classic kind of sky riding. It's more like a Daisy, a dot matrix printer, where we're putting out little puffs of smoke that look like dot matrix letters, and it literally looks like you're typing in the sky. But we did fly something for a former Thunderbird pilot. We were over his house, basically putting up some sign.
Okay.
And I never know what the sign is when I get in the airplane. We usually find out when we get back. You're just flying wing. You're 40 feet away from the other airplane, and it's all line of breast kind of stuff, which is the hardest formation to fly. And we get back, and we'll see what's on social media. If you look up Sky Typers on January 1st, 2016, you'll see some interesting messages we left over the Rose Parade about Donald Trump.
Righto. I'm sure our viewers will go straight to that.
I had no idea, but it was pretty interesting. And I also do some flying for an air-to-air photography company here in the Pasadena area. And I've been doing some things with them for SpaceX, where we're taking in-flight video of them doing some re-entries or capsule testing and stuff like that as they try to get their new systems man-rated. Used to play a lot of golf, but geez, I can't come up with 4 to 6 hours to go do that anymore. I haven't lifted up a golf club probably in 3 years. Used to do biking every once in a while, and I kind of like that, but in LA, it's too dangerous.
I can just imagine, yeah.
I try to read as much as I can. I like reading. I'm working on classics now, and I happen to be reading Catcher in the Rye right now, which is kind of hilarious. Read through Dante's Inferno, and I stopped the series at Paradiso. That just ended up being too nice. The other two were much better, Purgatory and Hell. I'm just trying to stay on classics right now. But generally, I'll read some nonfiction every once in a while if my wife suggests I read something, because she usually has pretty good taste in that, and I'll read what she gives me. Yeah.
So this might be a stupid question. Favorite aircraft you've flown?
Yeah, I'm going to have to say the F-4.
I knew that would be the answer. Yeah. Okay, so one you wish you could have flown?
That's a real good question, because there's a lot of neat airplanes out there. I kind of wish I would have flown a DC-3.
Wow, really? Okay, that's
because that wasn't the first airplane I got on. The first airplane I got on was a Piper Comanche. Mm-hmm. My dad put me in the back seat. Him and his friend owned the airplane, and this was pretty close to 1960. It was sometimes 5 or 6 years old when we did this, and I swear he did an aileron roll. My dad.
He's not having it.
Saying he had not done it, but I think he did. So a Comanche would be fun to fly. Certainly a lot of military airplanes that I'd love to have climbed into. The F-18 is one of them. I initially wanted to fly the A-6. I just thought their mission was really wicked cool. So that would have been fun. I'm glad to have done what I did. Helicopters interested me early on, but now they just terrify me. They just look like
a death trap, aren't they? They're scary.
if you can see a helicopter, it can kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the European airplanes and the Russian airplanes, MiG-21, I would have loved to flown.
MiG-21, yeah.
The Fulcrum would be fun too. The Tornado, that would have been fun.
So, Hooter, finally, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
No, but a lot of people around me get sick of it.
Well, we certainly don't.
I hang out with a lot of pilots, and so we always break into stories. I try not to lead with that, but you know the old joke, hey, when you go to a party, how can you tell if there's a fighter pilot there?
He'll tell you.
You don't have to, he'll tell you. I try not to do that, but I am guilty of that sin.
Yeah. Well, Hooter, thanks very much for being on the show. It's much appreciated. And your story is pretty incredible. So thank you.
Well, thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun. And I'm happy to have done this. And I feel like I'm in great company.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And if you like what we do here, don't forget to head over to patreon.com/aircrewinterview to help us out for as little as $1 per month. Thank you, and see you soon.